The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Now, Dermot Ferger is one of Ireland's preeminent historians with a portfolio of work to rival any other in the country. And fresh off the heels of his Civil War book, Between Two Hells, Dermot is back with The Revelation of Ireland, 1995 to 2020, a history of how the country has transformed in just 25 years. And delighted to have Dermot in studio with us this morning. Morning, how are you?
Lovely to be here, Sean. Thanks.
So when you're doing history as such, is it easier or harder to do stuff you've actually lived through yourself?
I think it's harder. I suppose I was used over the years to burying myself in archival records that related to the distant past. And then you surface and you try and stitch together a narrative and make sense of it. And I mean, we still have to be driven by evidence even when we're writing about more recent history. But it is very different because you can't really remain detached or apart from it. It is a period that you've lived through, and there's no point in pretending that you can achieve some kind of complete detachment or objectivity. And I was conscious as well that I was writing about events that I had very strong feelings about, obviously, as any citizen did. I mean, when I was working on a previous book on the 20th century, I referred to the 1990s as the decade of revelations. I didn't know at the time that that was only the beginning of something that would become much, much bigger. So a lot of the book is about trying to come to terms with these public and private pasts and making sense of these revelations, but also being conscious when you're talking about writing about recent events, looking at them through a long historical lens. It's where you'd hope your historical training would come to bear, so that we're not just preoccupied with the headlines. We're interested in the roots and we're interested in investing the present with a consideration of the past. In other words, if we want to understand any of the big issues that have consumed us in the last 25 years, whether that's the health system or housing or the decline of the Catholic Church, or indeed, you know, positive developments such as the ending of the war in Northern Ireland and the bringing of peace and economic expansion and the changed texture of the society, that you do need to have a sense of how we have got here. You might remember an infuriating mantra that sometimes politicians were using where things were difficult. We are where we are. Mm-hmm. We can't accept we are where we are. We want to know the how and the why of where we are. So a lot of it is about trying to dig a bit deeper to make sense of those things.
So how do you go about that sense of detachment? Because obviously I'm conscious that I've covered a lot of the events that happened in this time span of your book. And when you say journalism is sort of the first draft of history, but at the same time, the past lends context, you see how things play out, you get that luxury, if you like, of knowing how something ended, which you don't necessarily have in some of the more recent events in the book.
No, you don't. And I mean, we have to acknowledge that when you're writing about recent history, all of your findings are provisional. They're quite tentative in some ways. And history is always about revisiting. It's also about revising. And when you consider some of the definitive declarations that are made in response to difficult events at that time, we have to revisit them and say, well, is that really the case? To give you an example, if you take all of the commissions or the tribunals, or the investigations into stories that emerged about our dark corners of our past. And sometimes there was a tendency to brandish them when they were published as documents of truth. And you have to ask yourself, well, what is a document of truth? Is there any such thing? There are so many different ways of approaching a particular issue. But we're also often dealing with fragments. And you can construct a narrative on the basis of different fragments, but you can't say this is a document of truth. So a part of it is about trying to get beyond that and say, okay, well, we are getting a version now of a particular story or a particular controversy. But that's all it is. It is a version. But I do think that one of the functions of historians, and it's important now, is to try and mediate an awful lot of the material that has become available digitally, which is a big change for a historian. I talked earlier on about, you know, sifting through archival material and, you know, the documentary record, and I'm very comfortable doing that. But with this book, I also had to absorb an awful lot of the sources that have become available digitally and on the web, and they can be overwhelming as well. But it's a reminder as well that we are living in what Tim Robinson, who was a great chronicler of the West of Ireland and the ancient past, he called the age of the shortcut. You and I are both living through the age of the shortcut. It's the kind of the tyranny of the unending now. And Eric Hobsbawm, the great historian in writing The Age of Extremes about the 20th century, when he was coming towards the end of the 20th century, he said, we have to be very careful here about ensuring that there is a public sense of history. In other words, that people are not just living in the now, that they have a sense of the public past of the times that they live in, because you can't make sense of these things unless you have a sense of that evolution. So part of the role of the historian is to try and facilitate that. It doesn't mean we're high priests with a monopoly on the truth and sermonizing about the past, but just to say that we have to consider nuance and context. It's very easy to develop a narrative of a failed state, for example, if you want to focus on many of the problems that have endured and that have been so difficult to tackle. But we have to have a broader sense there of where we fit into the wider picture. You know, Ireland has been a remarkably stable entity over the last 100 years, and we're still a young state, and we still have a strong sense of purpose, and you could say of place, often of solidarity. That doesn't mean there aren't fault lines. Of course they are. And in some ways they can widen. But, you know, when you compare us to some of the excesses elsewhere, we do appear to be doing okay. That's not in any way to downplay the difficulties people might be experiencing. But again, I was interested in aspirations. You know, we haven't managed wealth very well. One of the issues that was affecting Ireland's development for so long were those economic difficulties and the fact that so many people had to emigrate and leave the country. And there was that strong sense of a turnaround during the period that I'm writing about. Obviously, the Celtic Tiger, we all became consumed by the idea of a successful economic story. And yet, in many ways, it wasn't managed well. And you can see an awful lot of echoes in the present of that period as well in relation to what the priorities are. And I was very interested in the idea of grand long-term visions. You know, they're very old-fashioned. The idea that someone in a leadership position would articulate a strong sense of where they would like to take the country beyond soundbites. And we are living in an age of soundbites. And an awful lot of people do their business through constant emotive and short appraisals of very complex and difficult topics. But for somebody to actually say, well, I have a sense of where this country might be in 20 years, as opposed to just being dictated by the electoral cycle.
Do you see anyone in the span of your book who had that, or anyone now who does? Because if you think of the different figures, you had Bertie and everything that happened there, and then you had the Fine Gael government that came in and had to try and clean up the mess, and now you've got a surplus, a massive 21 billion euro surplus budget being delivered this week. Yeah. And yet I feel like that big picture you're talking about is sort of missing still.
Oh, I think it is still missing still. And I mean, no one individual political leader stands out in relation to articulating that long-term design. It's almost like they feel they would be hostages to fortune. And, you know, ideological debate is not something that is a deep part of our political culture. It hasn't been for a long time. And there's quite a lot of people trying to share the same space. It's one of the reasons why Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil finally got to formally share power after that era that we always call Civil War politics, that the idea of debating ideology or ideas is often frowned upon in Irish political culture. And Bertie Ahern was hugely successful. He was the most electorally successful politician since Eamon de Valera in the 30s and the 40s. But he did that largely by, in his own words, tramping the streets. He loved the idea of campaigning. He didn't want to be drawn in to big debates about the nature of Irish society. And, you know, a lot of politicians will be in that same space. What I found very interesting, particularly in looking at how peace was brought, for example, to Northern Ireland, are the visions that were there on the part of senior civil servants, for example, who weren't household names. They had to do an awful lot of the often tedious work of drafting and redrafting. And the way John Chilcot put it, he was working in the Northern Ireland office, and he said, we have to move from metaphorical language to hard, sharp points. In other words, can you spot the subtle shifts when people are prepared to compromise and to abandon their trenchant positions? And can you work on that, and can you build something out of that? And the people who are working on those kind of things are often those who are devising policy or drafting position papers. They're not necessarily those who are in front of the cameras giving soundbites. And yet those people who are masters of the soundbites ultimately do have to often push things over the line. And Bertie Ahern was very good at that. And it's interesting to look at his relationship with Tony Blair. People who have, as young politicians, and they were only in their 40s back then in the late 1990s. And there's a sense of optimism and change, and that they can dispense with the baggage of their political forefathers and perhaps not be as burdened by the weight of history. And yet, we're not uniquely burdened by the weight of history. That's another one of the messages of this book. I think we have to think about Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and their struggles with democracy and the legacies and historical baggage that they're dealing with, we have a tendency sometimes not to place ourselves in that broader context. And even when it comes to quality of life issues or housing or health or what I call the social contract, I got very interested in the Nordic countries and how they think and measure quality of life and a level of living which is not just about material success or possessions. It's also about mental health and it's about physical health. You know, the Finns and the Swedish are much more interested in that kind of approach than we are.
Yeah. How do you, I suppose, put a scope, if you can, on Anglo-Irish relations in the 25 years you cover? Because it covers so much from the Good Friday Agreement, the relationship you talked about between Bertie and Tony Blair, right up to Brexit and the two very different tracks that the countries now seem to be
that
on.
That's fascinating. I mean, I found myself in the parliamentary archives in Westminster at the height of the Brexit crisis. And Boris Johnson, as British Prime Minister, had prorogued the British Parliament illegally, as it turned out. And at the time, I was going through documents relating to Winston Churchill and David Lloyd George during the War of Independence period. And they had very strong views, obviously, on Ireland and the need to tame the wild Irish. But they were so serious about the business of politics. And we were serious about the business of politics when it came to Brexit almost 100 years later. And it just struck me the gulf that had emerged between Britain and Ireland in terms of how you manage the serious business of politics as the Tories imploded. And there was an awful lot of immaturity there as well. And the Scottish journalist A.A. Gill used to write about snorting a line of that most pernicious and debilitating drug, nostalgia. And there was an empire nostalgia which flexed our nationalist muscles. So things were very fraught and very difficult there in the cauldron of Anglo-Irish relations. But that had come after a period where we said they had never been better. Bertie Ahern went to London in 2007 to address the British Houses of Parliament and said the relationship has never been closer. The Queen, Elizabeth II, came here in 2011. And again, the narrative was one of reconciliation. And it, you know, Brexit really shifted the ground.
It did. It's remarkable, I find, covering obviously politics every day, how much it went from Fine Gael and the Tories being very, very closely aligned and Enda Kenny trying to copy David Cameron's electoral strategies to now, I mean, they're miles apart as political entities.
They are. And they still, of course, prize what they achieved together. And we shouldn't forget that. I had to remind myself of just how difficult the 1990s was in relation to the prize that was at stake and the urgency around ending the killing. You know, over 3,600 people had been killed. But it's very difficult then. It's one thing to get an agreement over the line. It's very difficult to actually implement it. And peace processing in itself became an end in itself. But it's not the end, of course, because you want to try and build a different kind of society and what they call a shared society. And you're not going to do that in 25 years. And I've been very interested in how an awful lot of younger writers in both the North and the South have approached these questions of transforming society or what their aspirations and preoccupations are now on the back of what that generation we're talking about now did or did not do, you know. And, you know, we can be very positive about a lot of that. You know, there's great talent there and, you know, our cultural assets are so significant. You know, it's one of the great things we have to offer the world is how far our creativity can travel. So it's not all about being negative about that. But there are an awful lot of people trying to make sense of the last 25 years in their different ways. And different generations have different ways of approaching that question, you know.
One of the quotes that caught me from the book, if historians abandoned contemporary history, it would be left to the propagandists. And to go back to the point you were making earlier about digital archives, I'd say a lot of historians studying the Middle Ages or whenever, to take whatever point in history, would love contemporary accounts from real people. And now we have it in social media and millions and billions of posts every day. But of course, it's not quite as simple as that because they're all coming with an agenda.
Yeah.
There's these, you know, bot farms in different countries being used to influence the news. So is social media a net plus for the historian or does it make your life a lot more complicated?
Well, I often see social media as an enemy of the historian and I don't use it myself. And I am not for a moment denying what it has facilitated. And there are a lot of benefits in relation to how you can communicate and an audience that you can reach. And we have to acknowledge the reality of how people are growing up in relation to social media. But it can often lead to an assault on nuance and on truth and on accurate information. And for all the challenges of contemporary history in relation to perspective and distance and objectivity, we do still have to be driven by evidence. And an awful lot of people who are doing their business through social media are trying to mark out their territory, are trying to push a particular agenda. They're not remotely interested in the accuracy of evidence or indeed evidence itself. So that's a very, very dangerous place. And it's a very, very dangerous development in relation to how, again, complex issues are communicated. And you just simply cannot tease out those complexities. And when we take a big theme now, which is consuming so many European countries, immigration, what we might call the politics of belonging, and all of the layers attached to that in relation to rights and responsibilities. And fault lines can open up that keyboard warriors then deliberately set out to widen. And there are some who see Ireland as fertile ground now for that. And it's a big part of our recent story, of course, is the changed texture of Ireland. In 2011, 17% of the people in this country were from outside of Ireland. And that was the great historical role reversal, because we historically had always gone away. Now, if you're trying to make sense of a complex subject like immigration, is social media really going to facilitate the kind of debate that you need, or the kind of layered approach that you need? I doubt it.
Jimmy Ferrier, listen, it's a fascinating book. It's been fascinating talking to you as well. Thanks so much for coming in to News Talk to chat to me this morning. Appreciate it. If people do want to get that book, it is The Revelation of Ireland 1995 to 2020, covering an awful lot of ground for something that only covers 25 years, but there's a hell of a lot in it. And Dermot is also going to be in conversation with Justine McCarthy about the book at the Drumminear Nina Literary Festival on Thursday, the 10th of October. Tickets for that are available from www.dnlf.ie.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.